As the saying goes, a picture is worth a thousand words, and that's doubly true for the infamous crime duo Bonnie and Clyde.
The bank robbers exploded into the national imagination after candid, even playful photographs of them ended up in newspapers around the world. Authorities found their undeveloped film at the scene of a crime. The pictures took on a life of their own. A new PBS documentary tells their story.
In a world where there was very little to get excited about in summer 1933, Bonnie and Clyde were pretty big news.
Everybody was talking about the criminals, the bad guys. But Clyde and Bonnie had the one thing the others didn't, the whole true romance and the sexy scandal.
The story of Bonnie and Clyde by American Experience broadcasts on your local public television station tonight at 8 o'clock. And joining us now to talk about their lives is Buddy Barrow, the nephew of Clyde Barrow. Buddy, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you, ma'am.
Well, I want to hear in your words, how would you explain the appeal that Bonnie and Clyde had, why people were drawn to them despite this trail of crimes behind them?
Well, I think it had a lot to do with the Depression, how the banks were foreclosed on a lot of people's property. You know, people that worked hard, and when the banks failed, they just lost everything they had, their money and everything. They couldn't produce anything, you know, the farm. They couldn't get money to produce any crops or anything. So Clyde just, you know, hated the poverty part, and I guess society was really rooting them on because they were actually doing banks were what was doing to them.
So the poverty aspect of both of their lives is something that seems like it threw them together early on. They both came from, just sounds like, utter poverty. How did that shape what they wanted to do and what they wanted for themselves?
Well, you know, even at the time, jobs were scarce, and Clyde's older brother, Buck, he was just a, what you call a huckster. He would go to these, like my grandfather, he would go to these job sites and clean up these different areas, you know, to construction sites. Once they got through, they wanted the area cleaned of all debris, you know, excess lumber, iron, whatever. And then I think Buck had got a hold of some copper, and I think there was a misunderstanding, and he took this copper. Of course, he had Clyde helping him, and next thing you know, this copper winds up being stolen, and these two boys are now, you know, headed for real bad trouble.
And part of the formative years of or experience of Clyde, he ended up in jail really early on. What happened to him when he was in jail?
Well, after he was sent to sent to Eastern Prison for him, of course, that was probably one of the most brutal penal systems as it was in the country. And of course, Clyde, being a little 19-year-old kid, he had no idea what he was, you know, going to be facing with it, some of these people in there, because they were hardened criminals, some of them pedophiles. And when you get a young kid in there, sometimes these guards were just as ruthless as the criminals themselves, and they'll turn a blind eye to some of these pedophiles. And then when Clyde was raped, apparently the guy picked the wrong guy to rape, and I think Clyde, took a piece of pipe and split the guy's skull. Of course, that was Clyde's first murder. Now this young boy has really seen some really bad things. He saw things that couldn't imagine that another human being would do to another human being. And this changed Clyde dramatically. From that point home, the family just, they didn't know what to expect from him.
And he got pardoned from that prison sentence. But as you said, it sounds like he left that experience thinking, as far as prison went, never, never again. And how did that inform what happened later?
Well, what happened when he came back to Dallas, law enforcement had a policy that if you were a known ex-con, they had a procedure where they would harass you to the point to make you move out of their jurisdiction. And when I say harass you, they'd pick you up just for anything. And Clyde would actually have a job, and he was trying to work and make a living. And if something happened, well, they knew where to find him. And West Dallas was full of, some of these people who were just, no matter what you did, you couldn't change the way they already changed their life. So once they knew where Clyde was, they'd pick him up and take him downtown for questioning, see if he knew anything about these different crimes. Well, this went on and went on, and finally his employers would just let him go. You know, they just couldn't have that going on. And no sooner than he'd be taken down for investigation, they let him out, and he'd be walking home, and another second detective would pick him up. Well, this went on to a point that he just told his mom. He said, you know, the number going to let me be in peace. He says, I'll see him in hell. And when he struck out, he meant just that.
Now, you've got a unique position in all this as Clyde Barrow's nephew. Can you tell us a little bit about what Clyde and Bonnie were like?
Well, I never knew them. I mean, I knew all the rest of the Barrow family, and, of course, I know Bonnie's niece. They were all Christian people, you know, and they hated to see what happened to those two kids, you know, and once they got involved in something, they just went downhill from there. And then when Clyde committed his first murder, he knew he was a dead man. And they did everything they could to try to convince him to, you know, surrender. And Clyde knew that once he killed that first guy that, you know, there was no turning back. And Bonnie chose to stay with him when she was in a real bad car wreck and burnt to the point that, you know, she couldn't hardly walk, couldn't really take care of herself. And Clyde nurtured her and, you know, and took care of her. And she saw that devotion in him, and she was willing to go to her death with him.
We're talking right now to Buddy Barrow, nephew of Clyde Barrow of the crime duo Bonnie and Clyde, and the story of Bonnie and Clyde by American Experience, broadcast tonight on public TV stations at 8 o'clock. And so you didn't know Clyde Barrow or Bonnie for that matter, but what did you hear at the family gatherings among your family? Were they thought of warmly? Did people really care about them, even though they had done all these terrible things?
Well, when I was growing up, this was a subject that the younger kids weren't allowed to listen to. I didn't really, I mean, I heard bits and parts, but as far as knowing everything, one time I had, we went over to my aunt's home, and of course I jumped out of the car and run in the house first. Well, my aunt was going through a bunch of photographs, and when I saw the photographs of the car, it was all shut up and all that stuff, and I was asking questions, and my dad just said, hey, boy, go outside and play. I'll talk to you later about this, you know, and that's mm-hmm. the way it was until I became a teenager. And, of course, I had learned from the older kids asking questions, and I'd overheard some of the conversations that, you know, they were having with my grandfather and my aunts and all that. And so I just started putting two and two together, and then when I was probably about 11 or 12, my dad asked me if I wanted to go with him on some road trips because he was a truck driver. And it was during spring, you know, summer break. So we'd go all over the place. Go up Arkansas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, Missouri, Kansas. We'd go through some of these places where Clyde and Bonnie had actually, you know, been involved with some things there in those towns. And my dad would tell me some of the stories. And as long as I kept my mouth shut and didn't ask no questions, he'd just keep on talking. Mm-hmm. But once I asked a question, you just say, you know, I'm tired of talking about this. I don't want to talk about it no more. Mm-hmm. So I learned just to, you know, keep my ears open, my mouth shut.
Well, we got to talk about these pictures that they left behind because they really changed everything in terms of the way the world saw them, brought the world in on their story. Tell us about these pictures that were left behind at a crime scene. I think it was in Joplin.
Right. These photographs were never, ever to reach the public's hand. What had happened, most of the film, when they were out clowning around, they'd give the film to the family, and the family would have them developed and, you know, divide them between the family members. But there was actually film that was left in the Joplin house that, of course, there was a marriage certificate and Clyde's parole papers, and then when they found the pictures of these people, now they know who they were. And once they knew who they were, of course, they sent all these photographs to different news media throughout the United States, and this is who they're looking for. And then another occasion happened in Dallas just outside of Sowers, and there was three rolls of film left there, so they knew exactly who they were looking for. And once they had that, then, you know, their days were numbered.
And these pictures, at least the ones that really capture the public's imagination, they weren't typical pictures for the time, especially of Bonnie. You know, they showed her chomping on a cigar and holding a gun. How did that, do you think, go over at the time?
Well, I, you know, like I said, it was just like two kids clowning around, like, you know, some of the kids do, acting dumb, you know, and you got a weapon. And of course, Bonnie hated the picture with her with the cigar, because now they started calling her cigar, smoking mall, and she hated that. And like I said, once these photographs got out, you know, it was labeled. You know, like I said, their days were numbered once they knew these photographs were out.
And how do you think Americans felt when Bonnie and Clyde were killed, when their deaths, I mean, there are pictures of the funeral in this documentary, the thousands of people there. I mean, do you think there were mixed feelings about the end of Bonnie and Clyde?
Yeah, they had all these migrant farmers and that were traveling place to place looking for work and this and that. Clyde and Bonnie would get in with these people and buy food from them, you know, and may stop at a door, knock on a door, and they could smell the beans or cooking, and they'd buy this stuff from them. And then once they saw what was actually taking place, you know, that why they were doing what they were doing, I guess it was like a soap opera. People were following every move they made, you know, just to see if they were going to get caught, when they were getting caught. Because Clyde was probably one of the most elusive Depression outlaws there were. Once he started running, he wasn't caught until the day they killed him. So they were actually rooting for him.
Well, the documentary, it's so interesting to watch. It's hard to pull away from it, but this is a factual representation. How do you feel about the way Hollywood took on Bonnie and Clyde back in the 60s?
Yeah, the family did everything we could to stop the 1967 film. My grandmother was arrested, I don't know how many times, in 1934, because they were showing these documentaries at different theaters. She would go up to the theater, pull them billboards off and all the advertisement, and they arrested her and took her to jail for that. You know, she wasn't trying to publicize what Clyde and Bonnie did. I mean, it broke her heart to lose a child or two kids in the manner that they did. And she thought it was disgraceful that they would, you know, dramatize them so big whenever the family was heartbroken over what happened. And not only that, they felt sorry for the families that were involved.
And we got to leave
it there. Lost her family.
Buddy, thank you. Fascinating stuff. Thanks for joining us.
You're so welcome.
That was Buddy Barrow, nephew of Clyde Barrow. And the story of Bonnie and Clyde by American Experience is on tonight on Public TV.